poem from Wendell Berry. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and what my children's lives may be, I go and I lie down where the wood drake rests in the beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the world and am free. When I was a child, I built forts, as children do. I would drag all the kitchen chairs into the living room and cover them with a blanket and connecting them to the couch so that there was a lovely, cozy place underneath. And I would squeeze in my parents' big, soft quilt. It was so old and warm and meltingly soft. I would cuddle down in that supple fabric under my tent where the light and sound were muted and the world could not touch me, and I felt absolutely safe. And that is my first memory of sanctuary. It has been a hard week. It's been a really hard week, in fact. On Monday, Brett Kavanaugh, a man who does not have the support or trust of a significant number of Americans, and barely half of Congress, of the Senate, began serving on the Supreme Court. And he is expected to rule in ways that will violate UU values, particularly values of compassion and democracy and care for the interdependent web that makes life possible. The very same day, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report came out with its direst warnings yet. And as if to drive that point home, on Wednesday, Hurricane Michael, which brewed in the unusually warm Caribbean waters, smashed into land with 155-mile-per-hour winds, one of the strongest hurricanes to ever touch the United States in our history. And then on Tuesday, the Supreme Court effectively disenfranchised the Native American population of North Dakota, as well as other poor voters without street address. A report soon came out about Georgia's grievous voter suppression tactics. In the middle of the week, the International Monetary Fund came out with a report saying there would be global economic impacts from the trade wars and a myriad of other things. And soon after, the stock market began to fall in its worst losses since 2008. And while it came up a bit on Friday, it certainly served as a reminder of how shaky our economy is, how built on faith. I've often wondered at moments like these when something changes from one thing into another, like the moment a marriage moves from workable to unsavable. I think about that now. When was the moment when my country was a democracy and then it wasn't? Did the moment that fossil fuels began to irreparably damage the planet feel different than the moment before? When the stock market crashed in 1929, did ordinary people, like my grandparents' families, know right then that they might get close to starving? Posing these questions actually makes me realize that there are no clear lines. There is no day when a marriage went from workable to unsavable. The causes of the end of a relationship are so very often there at the beginning. In our country, democracy has almost always been a fiction, if you read the history. And well before engines were ever invented, Western people had used the earth and its gifts as a resource and not worried much about the health of ecosystems. The future is always there, if you know what you're looking for. But sometimes we don't know what to look for, or even that we should be looking. And other times we just don't look. What happens instead is one day we wake up. Our relationship is unbearable. We can no longer pretend we live in a democracy. We can't not see that our government oppresses and hurts people because of their skin color or immigration status. We have to notice, because there's 155-mile-an-hour winds, that what the scientists said would happen to the Earth if it warmed too much are actually happening today, now. I've woken up to these realities before. And what do I want each time the evidence is clear that the world I live in can be so unsafe and so unkind? I want to be that 5-year-old that I once was, wrapped up in my favorite blanket, hidden in my fort, underneath the chairs, away from the world. I want to feel safe. I want sanctuary. Sanctuary comes from the Latin sanctus, for holy. In medieval times in Europe, people running from the law were safe in the holy church. And sanctuary came to have that meaning that we often give it today: refuge, safety, shelter, retreat. The word sanctuary connotates a sense of freedom away from the raging storm, literal storms, figurative storms, internal storms. And that is the kind of sanctuary that I crave. I want to close my eyes and retreat from the storm that is my country, unsafe and unkind to so many people, and to the earth on which we are utterly dependent. I don't build my own blanket and chair forts anymore, even though I will go in if a child does invite me. Still, I have adult versions of sanctuary. My couch, watching a really funny show. My habitual walk through the forest with my novel on my headphones, my garden, my yoga class. And yes, these sanctuaries are sometimes about caring for myself, relaxing and recharging, and those are the best uses of sanctuary. But sometimes, they're just about closing my eyes. They are just about hiding from the storm. I do not want to live in these times. This week I can't make my eyes close. I can't pretend even a little bit that whether I get the garden things cleared out of my carport before my neighbors complain, or if I make it to exercise class, or if I really will ever catch up with the rest of the world on This Is Us and the unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt are important matters of my private life. I saw two of the men who had been imprisoned in Sheraton, legal asylum seekers, tortured by cold, by hunger, by withheld medical treatment, by confinement. They were so young. They were in their 20s. They are the ages of my sons. I saw the picture of a little girl who was killed in Hurricane Michael. A carport blew into her home. She was my daughter's age. My country is abusing other people's children. My country prefers supporting the fossil fuel industry to stopping carports from blowing into people's homes. The kind of shelter, the kind of sanctuary that shelters me away from that world is no longer working. The world just keeps coming in through the cracks. My life has been full of other kinds of sanctuaries, not just the fort kind of sanctuaries. Playing cards and laughing with my family. At a lake where afternoon in the summer, for many years, my sons and I would go and swim away the worst heat of the day. And hugs with those people I've loved. The ocean. And routine walks through my neighborhoods. These were not sanctuaries of separation for safety and respite, but sanctuaries of connection with people and places that have nourished me. People and places that have held me when I was happy, when I was sad, when I was energized and creative, and when I was exhausted and burnt out. When I had it together, and when the balls I was supposed to hold fell all around me. These were sanctuaries that reminded me of who I belonged to my families and friends, to my neighbors, to the land, to the animals. Knowing who I belonged to recalibrated me so I could be who I was. The first UU church I joined was such a sanctuary of belonging. I was a new mother in a new town, and the only moms that I had managed to hook up with at all really loved decorating and shopping. And as an evergreen grad with hippie parents, I simply didn't get it. It bored me out of my mind. I was desperate for something else. I showed up at a UU church and discovered a place where people cared about things that mattered, like being kind to other people and the planet. I was so happy. And to make things even better, they watched my baby and three-year-old while I sat for uninterrupted hour of music and poetry and interesting, well-thought-out reflection. I was so happy, and I really felt welcomed and as if I belonged. This week, when my eyes won't shut, I need that kind of belonging. I need to know whose I am and where I fit. I need to find my place in the world. And I am so grateful to have this kind of sanctuary in my life. These amazing weeks of fall weather remind me each day that I am a child of the earth and the sun. I treasure the hot sun on my skin as I sit on my porch in the afternoons. My eyes feast on the vibrant red and yellow leaves on the trees. Water sparkles in the light. I have felt so grateful to be alive on this earth. I have felt nourished and renewed. The earth is a sanctuary for me. I am also so grateful to this congregation. We are people together, people who have committed to being together, who are committed to the same values. Being here, I feel centered. I remember who I am and what matters to me. I remember the goodness of people. This congregation is a sanctuary for me. The word sanctuary comes from the Latin for the holy. In a spiritual context, that shifts the meaning of sanctuary a bit. Sanctuary becomes something more than shelter or refuge. It becomes more than belonging and knowing who I am. When sanctuary is holy, it calls us into service of that which is greater than ourselves. And now in this moment, I need more than sanctuaries of safety and belonging. I need holy sanctuary. I need the kind of sanctuary that prepares me to be a sanctuary. I need the kind of sanctuary that prepares me to be a sanctuary in service of which that is greater than me. And right now, what is greater than me is Unitarian Universalist values. The values that tell me each person has inherent worth and dignity. Each person's voice matters. And so does this interdependent web, which we have an obligation to care for as it cares for us. And I want those values to be the lived values in the world. I want those values to be the ones that shape the society we live in. Yesterday, Blair L.M. Kelly, a Black history professor, in a column in the New York Times, wrote about the Black civil rights movement that happened before the one that we always refer to when we say civil rights movement. She wrote about the civil rights movement that rose to fight the establishment of segregation. Because, yes, there was a time between the end of slavery and segregation. So for 40 years, in the late 19th century and early 20th century, Black people and their white allies fought state and local governments who began to pass segregation laws. And when state and local courts passed these laws, the activists went to court saying that the laws violated the Constitution, and the courts, all the way up to the Supreme Court, ruled against them over and over. And so they marched, and so they wrote, and they lobbied, and they boycotted, and they had sit-ins, and they lost. Segregation became the ironclad law of the South. So did voter suppression schemes. At that very same time, workers of all races were losing in conservative, pro-corporation, anti-work, anti-minority courts. The High Court ruled consistently that the government could not pass laws that promoted worker well-being, including safety and minimum wage laws. For decades, workers, Black people, and other minorities lost in court. However, ordinary people never gave up. They never stopped working to create a world where all people would be treated fairly. They did not take no for an answer. And those are our ancestors. Movements are about more than moments, writes Dr. Kelly. They are about thoughtful networks of dissent built over time. Those thoughtful networks of dissent grew stronger. The people finally gathered so much political power that Franklin D. Roosevelt had a power stare down with the Supreme Court. He said he would just add more people to the Supreme Court. We would change the Constitution. And he had the power to do it. And the court flinched. They started ruling in a more pro-labor way, allowing, for example, a law for minimum wage in Washington state. They allowed it to stand. And when those men died, Roosevelt put his own men on the court, and that is the court that overturned the precedent to end segregation and voter suppression laws. I know what a sanctuary of safety and refuge is like. It is a retreat away from the action of the world. It is private. It is quiet. We can catch our breath and breathe deeply. We can listen for the small, deep voice within. I know what a sanctuary of belonging is like. It connects us with places and people. It has a voice, and it is a pleasant voice, like the breeze or a baby cooing or laughter. It nurtures, it hugs, it smiles. In those sanctuaries, we can find ourselves in the other. And I know something about holy sanctuary. I know it exists when we invite someone in who needs help or is in danger, and we grant them safety. I know Holy Sanctuary exists when any community helps us access our strength and courage so that we can act in ways that we believe. In this moment, I believe we need other forms of holy sanctuary. We need a holy sanctuary that prepares us to be a sanctuary. A holy sanctuary that keeps inviting people in until all are seen and valued. A holy sanctuary that creates an ark over all, transforming our world. I don't know exactly what those holy sanctuaries are like. I do imagine that they might be like Dr. Kelly's thoughtful networks of dissent. We each hold two or more hands dissenting together, walking with, listening to, caring for. Each pile of gripped hands is a node in that network until it stretches taut and strong everywhere. Or maybe Holy Sanctuary is like the Emerge journey from Sheridan to Norcore that I walked for a day and a bit. The 7-day march demanding Oregon institutions stop contracting with ICE and asking for no votes from everyone on Measure 105. Maybe Holy Sanctuary is where people of all sorts, like in the march, short and tall, brown and white, young and old, Jewish, Christian, and atheist, join and leave as their energy allows, express horror and hope, strategize and consider, walk and sing, grimace at blisters and sore muscles, pass water and granola bars, laugh and eat, always saying, "Let our people go. We insist, we demand people be treated fairly and kindly. Let our people go." Or maybe Holy Sanctuary is like the story of the Transylvanian church. We help build the world we dream of, each sharing our own gifts and then painting it with the most joyful, colorful images that we know. We bring our light to the sanctuary. We bring our gifts. And then we take that light back to our own homes, where it nurtures us. I wonder, perhaps, if private sanctuaries, sanctuaries of belonging, and holy sanctuaries are best when they flow one into another. If we have private sanctuaries of safety and respite, sanctuaries where we belong and discover who we belong to, and holy sanctuaries where we invite others in and come out glowing with the light of our own values, filled with love and compassion, demanding that the world transform to be a safer, kinder place. I just can't tell you how much I want to retreat into that fort of my childhood and just close the world out. I want to get caught up in my personal concerns, the things that matter to me, my family, my interests, what I want to do, where I want to travel, what I want to see. And then I think of the interaction between Frodo and Gandalf at the end of the Lord of the Rings 1 movie. "I wish the ring had never come to me," Frodo says. "I wish none of this had happened." "So do all who live to see such times," Gandalf replies. "But that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us." So I hope for each of us that we find refuge and respite in our private sanctuaries. But I hope that we do not stay there. I hope we do not hide. I hope for each of us that we find sanctuaries of belonging where we feel deep connection to that which holds us and cares for us. I also hope we do not stay there. I hope instead we are like Frodo or Sam, and that we have the courage to step out into the discomfort of injustice, the discomfort of strangers, the discomfort of not having any idea what we should do, and the discomfort of losing. And there I hope we find a new holy sanctuary, a place of safety among others, centering, deep connection, and a sense of light beyond anything we have ever known or imagined before. I hope most of all that we do it together and we help each other along the way. Kim asked this morning, "Will you be my refuge?" And that's what I ask of you. Will you be my refuge? Will you be each other's refuge?